And now, the tradition continues as WABC presents John Gamblin with the mayor of the greatest city in the world, Mike Bloomberg.
Johnny Donovan, you've got it right one more time. Hello, everybody. Welcome aboard our Friday get-together here at 77 WABC. John Gamblin, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the mayor not in studio today on the phone. Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning, John. How are you?
I am fine. Where are you dialing us from?
I am in Idaho, Sun Valley, Idaho, where it's clear skies and temperatures should be in the 80s today.
And you were attending a media and technology retreat. It's an annual thing, isn't it?
It's an annual thing. I used to go all the time. I was here 2 years ago. It's a good chance to talk to a lot of people who have companies around the world and get them to move to New York, or companies that are in New York, and tell them what we're doing so that they continue to expand. And also, there's a lot of people here who are very generous and have given us a lot of money to help the school system, whether it's to build small schools or to train principals or to have programs that help teachers. And so it's a chance to spread the word and fundraise a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what the CEO is supposed to be doing, right? Doing all those good things. Good for you. Let's get to some of the things that are happening here. Earlier the week, the bombings in Bombay, India. I thought it interesting the next morning as I was taking the Long Island Railroad train, the platform announcements about if you see something, say something, and the bag inspection announcements, which run probably on a regular basis every 10 minutes or so, 12 minutes, were being repeated about every minute. Obviously, one of the responses, do you have an automatic plan? Does the city have an automatic plan when something happens like this around the world for New York City?
Well, you got to remember that we have stayed at a high level of security, a higher level than the rest of the country ever since 9/11. We've never backed off. And one of the things we try to do is to every day change our tactics, where people are deployed, whether you can see them or not, whether you have a bag search or here or there, an advertising campaign. When something like the tragedy in Mumbai happens, clearly people want to be reminded that we are doing everything we can. So to some extent, it's really to put people's mind at ease. It's not in practice very much more security all of a sudden because of that. We have to do that every single day. Remember, we're in the business of prevention, not responding. You respond only as the last resort. What we try to do is to make this so unattractive a target for a terrorist that they will not strike here. But I think there's no question when you have an event like we did the other day, people want to just one more time be reassured. And, you know, the trouble is they don't normally listen to those warnings. Now, all of a sudden, you hear it more. Maybe it's not even being played more, but
maybe
you
right.
Certainly pay attention to it.
Yeah, maybe you're absolutely right. Been a lot of talk this morning in town about this flood wall downtown and its vulnerability, something I don't think most of us have thought about. How high on the list of potential dangers is this?
Well, we want to make sure that anything that is number one, is vulnerable, gets protection, and number two, particularly the vulnerable places that might be targets. Clearly, the World Trade Center site is not just another piece of real estate. It's a place where America was attacked, where we lost 2,800 of our friends and relatives and people who rushed into buildings to save others. And so you want to make sure that that gets a little extra protection because it is, in theory, and more likely to be a target. The bathtub itself normally would be held back by all of the steel structure underneath. That steel structure isn't there at the moment. We put these reinforcing rods in there. If you look at the walls, you'll see these things sticking out. Those are cables that get drilled way into the ground behind to hold it up. And we just want to make sure that nobody thinks that they could cause more chaos down there.
Chuck Schumer and others getting some money from the federal government for port security, reading about that this morning. I also have been reading that those shortfalls from the federal government on terror money from the feds is now going to come from the state.
The federal government, when they distribute money, almost every time only goes to states. The states then have to redirect it to cities, and cities are always complaining that states charge a little bit for administration. Because they have other things to do. In all fairness, Governor Pataki really has stood up here and said, I'm just giving it all to New York. But that's more of a technical thing of it coming through the states. The money here, I think, was meant for the city and because it's just much more likely to be a target.
Okay, so there's really no state money involved here.
I think the monies that you're talking about, listen, the state does a lot for us, although we send a lot of money up to the state. As a matter of fact, we send $11 or $12 billion every year, more to the state than they send back to us, and I complain about it every year. But these monies I think you're talking about are federal monies. The federal government distributes them through the state. The governor is sending them. He has some discretion, I think, to use them for the region. He said, look, New York City is the target. I'm giving it all to the city. In terms of the money support security, there are a number of ways you get into a country, and there are vulnerabilities. People think that you could put a big bomb or terrorists in one of these shipping containers, and so how you protect that and look at everything. There are programs where we inspect them overseas and then seal them. There are programs where we inspect them when they get here. What I think people don't realize is just the number of containers that go in and out of America, whether it's on trucks, on airplanes, or on ships, is so great that you probably could never inspect every single one and still have a functioning economy. And it's like the subways. You find ways to protect where you can't be every place, and you do it by constantly changing your tactics and not having the bad guys know what you're looking and who's looking.
You know, but just before we take a break, a real fast question here. Your reaction to the destruction of that building here in New York City. Boy, we get stories you just never could even comprehend.
And nobody could comprehend it. I mean, I don't know what else you say. If it wasn't so tragic, you could laugh at it. But, you know, thank God nobody was killed. We actually have a city employee working for the summer in one of our departments who was walking by and was struck by flying debris and was in the hospital for a couple of days.
Yeah, and a couple of firefighters as well. Mr. Mayor, stick where you are in Sun Valley, Idaho. We'll come right back. We're going to make a little money for the company here. We continue now. We continue here on the Friday edition of the John Gambling Show with Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the mayor on the telephone from Sun Valley, Idaho, attending a conference out there. Mr. Mayor, your cell phone ban in high schools just doesn't seem to want to go away. A lawsuit now being filed that they're claiming that it's unconstitutional, keeping that information or that technology out of the hands of the little ones.
Well, you know, if you want to get your name in the paper, if you want to pander to a handful of people, I guess this is the way you go about and do it. What we're going to do is we are going to have our schools focus on educating our kids. And the truth of the matter is, if the kids have cell phones or Blackberries or iPods or any of these great devices that we all have gotten addicted to, if the kids have them in the classroom, they will use them. And they will be focusing on those rather than on what the teacher is saying. And there's a place to use those devices. There's also a place for getting the education you're going to need for the rest of your life, and that's in the classroom. There's no question our priorities are, and I'm very confident that no court, or certainly if there is a court, no appeals court, would allow would take away our rights to maintain the kind of environment in the classroom that you need in order to learn. This is, you love these people say, well, I've got to stay in touch with my kid in an emergency. Well, you call the principal. Oh, well, maybe the principal won't think it's an emergency. I've got to know whether the kid wants to have fish or beef for dinner. There's plenty of time to find that out, but not during the classroom.
You know, in reading this and following it with along with you for all of these weeks, actually months now, I've always wondered, doesn't this sort of ban point to the fact that in the classroom there should be discipline, and that if Johnny Gambling pulls out his cell phone in class, the teacher says, Mr. Gambling, either you put that away or I'm going to confiscate it.
Well, the trouble is that the teachers have a lot of work to do. And if the, you know, it is true, John, if one kid had a cell phone, but when many have them, it's very hard to do it. And we've all been, I do a press avail most days, and we say no cell phones. And, you know, you've been at the conferences too. Somebody's speaking, and even when they announce, please turn off your cell phones in the middle of the speech, somebody's cell phone goes off. It's just the truth of the matter is, if the cell phones are there, if the iPods are there, they will be used. Some kids use them for entertainment rather than to pay attention to the teachers. Some kids, unfortunately, we had a case recently where kids use them to cheat in class. But, you know, we live in a day, in an age where you can, on your cell phone, watch a movie. You could, you can go on chat sites, you can email, you can play games, all sorts of things, which may be great, but just don't belong in the classroom.
So is the policy, so that it's clear, that if my child has a cell phone and walks through the front door and it is detected, it is confiscated?
That is correct, and we've had that policy for many years. It's just before we didn't enforce it, and as we've tried to ramp up security in the schools, which is in everybody's interest, today's technology not only detects weapons, it detects electronic devices, and neither are permitted in the schools, and so we'll confiscate it. But this is not a new law. What's new here is all of a sudden people have to obey it.
All right, let's the rule. Let's move along to the West Side Rail Yards and your offer, the city's offer to pay the MTA $500 million, actually in two different pots, really, a $300 payment and a $200 million payment.
Well, you know, this is a great opportunity for New York City, John, to expand and give people places to build apartments and parks and schools and office buildings. If you look at a map, or you drive by, it is one of the last great opportunities we have. Now, we're extending the number 7 line over there. The city's paying for a brand new subway line that will make all of this area very attractive. We've tried to develop this before. It's been sitting there for decades with nothing going on. If you remember when there was the plan to build a stadium, which sadly we did not get done, and unfortunately many people will just never get jobs they would have gotten. But regardless, we can't just walk away from that. We've got to go and build it. And if you remember, everybody said, oh, you know, it's we want an auction. We want it open to everybody. And it was open to everybody. And if you remember, Cablevision came rushing in with a $600 million bid. What do you think happened to that bid, John?
We haven't seen it since.
You got that one right. That was just a ways to try to hurt the city, but nobody was serious about it. What we're doing here, and Speaker Christine Quinn, it really is showing some courage because this is her district over there, and, you know, city council people tend to try to protect their areas and from development, but she understands this is the future of the city, and it is good for that area. And together we've made a very fair offer. Remember, the offer goes, the monies go to the MTA. We are part of the MTA. The MTA may be a state agency, but the city has members on the board. It may be a state agency, but its job is to provide mass transit for people in New York City or people coming and going to and from New York City. And the subway system, New York City owns that. The MTA doesn't own it. We lease it to the MTA, and they are the operating authority. But this is really buying something from ourselves, and it will give us the opportunity to then go out and to make let people compete for the rights to develop various things. But it will leave the city in charge of what is built there.
So you have no list of projects.
There's tons of things that people would like to be able to consider over there, and having the city in charge of this land rather than the state is, I think, that exactly what should happen. This is part of New York City. Why should we not be in control of this? And it's a fair price, and it would give us then the opportunity. I think we don't have any one list of projects, but we know that good development in this city requires mixed use, it requires open spaces, it requires good transportation, it requires schools, it requires a lot of things. And to just put it all up for bid to somebody who might want to come in and build something that is not in the city's interest, even if they paid a few dollars more, that's not good for this city. Money isn't everything. We want to have, we're just not trying to maximize our resources. We're trying to maximize the quality of life and the future of this city and our potential.
How about the financing of the $500 million?
The city will be able to do that. We can, you know, we have borrowing authority, and we have at the moment our revenues are going and going gangbusters. I don't think that's going to continue as the real estate market slows down, but we can afford this, and it's an investment, I think, John, that we can't afford not to do.
It actually seems to be cheap.
Many, many times over.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. It sounds to me that it's almost a very good buy.
It is a very good buy, and you know, people that just want to stop everything. I do not want to 20 years from now see the rail yard still there with nothing on and everybody yelling and screaming. And sadly, that's what would happen.
A lot of people are saying you'd get a lot more on the open real estate market. That's a question that, again, can't be answered unless the events are taking place. But again, let me just make sure I understand this clearly, that you want not necessarily to have the city develop anything, but we'll be able to sell the rights to somebody
exactly right.
Else.
What we want is the city to be in control of what goes there, and not somebody from outside the city or a private developer who's just trying to maximize his or her bottom line. This is just too important. The city should be in control. We should go through the normal land use processes, which is called democracy, and Christine Quinn is fully on board and deserves a lot of credit for being with us.
So considering the real estate market in New York and Manhattan specifically, this $500 million investment ultimately could be worth $2 billion.
It could be worth it. It can be worth the future of our city, John. This is just if you take a look at a map, that whole area, the whole West Side, has enormous potential for the city, and we've just got to make those investments now.
All right, Mr. Mayor, hang on. We'll get right back to you on the telephone. Mayor Michael Bloomberg right here on a Friday. John Gambling and Mayor Michael Bloomberg here at 77 WABC. The mayor on the phone from Sun Valley, Idaho, attending a conference out there. Mr. Mayor, the comptroller of New York City, William Thompson, Bill Thompson, with an audit on housing, pointing out that in a lot of instances, some of these vacant apartments are staying that way for upwards of 3 years. What's going on?
Well, I don't know there's anything for 3 years. What we're trying to do is to invest in our public housing. You know, most cities are blowing up. Literally, they blow up the public housing. You see these films on television of the houses imploding, and they clear the land, and then it stays vacant. Instead, we've invested over $2 billion in renovating and rehabbing the New York City Housing Authority's housing projects throughout the city. And what you have to do in some of these cases is, if you're going to change all the appliances and the wiring and the plumbing and redo the walls and the ceilings, you can only do that with people moving out. The vacancy rate is less than 2% in the citywide, and the guy that's running this, Tina Hernandez, is doing a spectacular job. If you go by public housing in this city, the lawns outside, there's no trash. 5 years ago, they used to look like it was a garbage dump. You go inside. We've improved the security. The police department is working as hard as they can to make these projects safe. Everybody has the right to live safely. And we're going to continue to do a good job, and Tino is doing is renovating and managing in a great way. We're also trying to make this something that the city can afford, and unfortunately we're in the process of raising some rents on people who are making more money than It was originally envisioned when they got these apartments, and they're paying a very small percentage of their income compared to people who don't have access to public housing. But at the same time, we're trying to protect those who just literally don't have any more money and make sure that they have a place to live.
Comptroller, focusing on this too closely or trying to make something out of nothing?
I don't know. I haven't read his report yet. I'll read it next week when I get back. And I did talk to Tino, and people talked to Tino, and I think we're doing exactly the right thing.
All right. There is word in the papers this morning that District Council 37, you're going to announce, I think, next week probably, a contract. And one of the things was that the city gave up the clause that said that city members of that union had to live in the city, residency law. The police and fire have gotten the permission as part of their contracts to live outside of New York City. Why? I think this is a good thing, by the way. Why was it necessary, do you think, or what was the thinking on making people who worked for the city live in the city?
Well, I don't want to talk about any contract that we haven't announced yet, but there was a point in time where people had no confidence in the city, and they were leaving in droves, if you remember. We had vacant buildings and vacant lots all over the city, and nobody thought New York City had a future. And I suppose in those days, a requirement that city employees live in the city made a lot of sense, because you just didn't want more people to leave. Today, we've really turned things 180 degrees around. Our big problem today is that more people want to live in New York City than we have housing for. And that's true at all levels of housing, from the most affordable to, I guess, what you could call the least affordable for many people. And if you did have a policy that created more demand, it might have been appropriate earlier. It's probably not appropriate now. Today, it would probably benefit everybody to give the ability to for people to spread out a little more. It would. We're trying to build affordable housing as fast as we can. We've in the process of building or rehabbing 165,000 units of affordable housing. The private sector is building an enormous number of market rate units. Just the city is this city this decade is going to add more people than live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I mean, just think about that. In one decade, we will grow more than 325,000 people living in this city. And the reason is that the streets are safer and cleaner, and the schools are getting better, and our cultural institutions are thriving, and the parks and open spaces make this a very lovable, good place to live. And companies are moving here. We have record low employment and record number of people working, and a record number of corporate headquarters here. But if the policies that were appropriate at a different time in the city's development may not be appropriate now. And
so the city, the city doesn't really care where you live if you work for the city. It should make no difference.
Imagine. I mean, there are arguments that you want to have, for example, your police officers who would be available off duty. A lot of them, carry their badges and guns. If they're living in the city, that's good. Because they could in an emergency fill in, or a teacher could see the kids in the neighborhood and help them, or a sanitation worker could see that there was a problem, and when he gets to work, say, hey, we got a situation in this corner, let's go clean it up. So there are arguments to have people live in the city, and one of which is, incidentally, the tax base. The city employees, even those that have the contractual right to live outside the city, also pay city taxes. So even though they live out, they still have to pay city taxes, and that's...
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, because we need the money.
Well, I understand that. I understand it from the bottom line point of view. Is it fair, maybe, was the better question.
Well, it was part of, I gather, it came out of a negotiation where they had to live in the city, so they were paying city taxes, and they wanted to live outside, and the city, I guess, negotiated half a loaf, something for everyone. The city kept the revenues, and the employees got more flexibility in where they could live. And they signed a contract to do so. So that's That's the way it came out from the negotiations.
In some of our conversations in the past couple of weeks, we have talked about hurricane preparedness. We've talked about bird flu. There's another report out this week on the pandemic and what the city would hope to do in that situation. I thought it interesting that your health commissioner basically said that we would try and affect behavior rather than medicine.
Well, emergencies require different responses. In some cases, you want to move people out, for example, from low-lying areas when a hurricane's threatening. In other cases, you want to keep people at home. In the case of a flu, which kills, incidentally, thousands of people, even in New York City, every year. We have flu every year. This is nothing new. This bird flu has gotten a lot of attention. At the moment, it's not a flu that seems to be transmitted from one person to another. You have to work with live poultry in order to catch it. At least so far, that's the way the flu is. What we're trying to do is to, if you we'll pass on the flu by coughing and sneezing in a room with other people. Number one, try not to be in a room with other people to the extent possible for the few days that you're contagious. And two, if you have to, face masks. It's simple technology, but it really does work. We forget that we really are in charge of our own bodies, and medicine can do some wonderful things, but eating right and not smoking and looking before you cross the street and putting bars on a window where you have young kids in the house, those are the kinds of things that really make a difference, and they're not sexy, but they work.
Did you happen to see, I know you've been out of town, but did you happen to see the report released, it's a poll really, released by the Citizens for New York City at Baruch College, talking and asking some of the leaders of the boroughs what they consider the biggest issues there. Citywide, street noise comes up number one, as you have always contended it would.
It's the number one complaint that we get on the citizen service hotline, otherwise known as 311. And we did this year pass a noise code, which hopefully will give the police a little more ability to stop people who are disturbing each other. We do have a level of noise in a big city different than in the country. That's, you're going to have to live with that. It's an exciting place, and people want to be excited.
I thought one of the interesting things about this, they broke it down by borough. In Brooklyn, for example, the number one complaint from these people that are involved in the government, parking shortage. In the Bronx, lack of youth activities. Staten Island, overdevelopment. And in Queens, illegal building conversions.
Yep, and when I do these town meetings every few weeks, those things come up and just pretty much the way you describe them.
Again, the attack on each and every one of these, overdevelopment in Staten Island, for example. I mean, there's not much the city can do, is there?
Yeah, sure. We are rezoning big parts of Staten Island. The borough president of Staten Island, Jim Molinaro, has been very helpful, and the three city council people there, Andy Lanzer and Jimmy Otto and Michael McMahon, all have worked very hard on getting the right balance between building housing for a growing population, but not destroying the character of different neighborhoods. What's happened on Staten Island, and it's really happened throughout all five boroughs, but Staten Island is somewhat unique in that the roads are much narrower. They were just built that way in the days when there wasn't the Verrazano Bridge, and Staten Island was much more separated from the city than it is today. And so it's hard to expand the population, but it's a very desirable place to live, and that's the market. The marketplace is telling you that. No matter how much the builders build, they seem to sell or rent it. But sometimes you wake up in your neighborhood, and all of a sudden there's a multi-story, multi-unit building where before there was a single-family unit, or somebody's built an enormous house in the middle of small houses. There's an apartment building with not indoor parking, and there's no places for people to park their cars. And this overdevelopment. It's what you can call a problem of success, but it's a serious problem nevertheless.
Absolutely. So I know you've got to go. You've got appointments, and we'll let you do that. Did your mother really call the New York Times and tell them you were born somewhere other than you've been saying?
My mother did not call the New York Times. What I understand, the Times called her, didn't identify themselves. The reporter said, where was he born? She answers questions.
So is it Boston or was it Medford?
I was born at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which I think is still open, in Brighton. And we lived in Brookline until I was 4 years old, but then we moved to Medford, and fundamentally, I have absolutely no recollection of being born in St. Elizabeth's Hospital or living in Brookline. I was a bit young at the time.
I would think you probably were. Mr. Mayor, thank you for your time this morning. We'll look forward to next Friday.
John, looking forward to it.
Have fun in beautiful Idaho, all
thanks.
Right? Thank you very much. Mayor Michael Bloomberg this morning here at 77 W.